In the long afternoon they toured the city turnwise of the river. Twoflower led the way, with the strange picture-box slung on a strap around his neck. Rincewind trailed behind, whimpering at intervals and checking to see that his head was still there. A few others followed, too. In a city where public executions, duels, fights, magical feuds and strange events regularly punctuated the daily round, the inhabitants had brought the profession of interested bystander to a peak of perfection. They were, to a man, highly skilled gawpers. In any case, Twoflower was delightedly taking picture after picture of people engaged in what he described as typical activities, and since a quarter Rhinou would subsequently change hands for their trouble, a tale of bemused and happy nouveau riche was soon following him in case this madman exploded in a shower of gold. At the Temple of the Seven-Handed Sek, a hasty convocation of priests and ritual heart transplant artisans agreed that the 100-span-high statue of Sek was altogether too holy to be made into a magic picture, but a payment of 2 Rhinou left them astoundingly agreeing that perhaps he wasn't as holy as all that. A prolonged session at the whore pits produced a number of colourful and instructive pictures, a number of which Rincewind concealed about his person for detailed perusal in private. As the fumes cleared from his brain, he began to speculate seriously as to how the iconograph worked. Even a failed wizard knew that some substances were sensitive to light. Perhaps the glass plates were treated by some arcane process that froze the light that passed through them. Something like that, anyway. Rincewind often suspected that there was something somewhere that was better than magic. He was usually disappointed. However, he soon took every opportunity to operate the box. Twoflower was only too pleased to allow this, since that enabled the little man to appear in his own pictures. It was at this point that Rincewind noticed something strange. Possession of the box conferred a kind of power on the wielder, which was that anyone confronted with the hypnotic glass eye would submissively obey the most peremptory orders about stance and expression. It was while he was thus engaged in the Plaza of Broken Moons that disaster struck. Twoflower had posed alongside a bewildered charm-seller, his crowd of newfound admirers watching him with interest in case he did something humorously lunatic. Rincewind got down on one knee, the better to arrange the picture, and pressed the enchanted lever. The box said,
"It's no good. I've run out of pink."
A hitherto unnoticed door opened in front of his eyes. A small green and hideously warty humanoid figure leaned out, pointed at a colour-encrusted palette in one clawed hand, and screamed at him.
"No pink, see?"
screeched the homunculus.
"No good you going on pressing the lever when there's no pink, is there? If you wanted pink, you shouldn't have took all those pictures of young ladies, should you? It's monochrome from now on, friend. All right?"
"All right, yeah, sure," said Rincewind. In one dim corner of the little box, he thought he could see an easel and a tiny unmade bed. He hoped he couldn't.
"So long as that's understood," said the imp, and shut the door.
Rincewind thought he could hear the muffled sound of grumbling and the scrape of a stool being dragged across the floor. "Twoflower," he began, and looked up. Twoflower had vanished. As Rincewind stared at the crowd, with sensations of prickly horror travelling up his spine, there came a gentle prod in the small of his back.
"Turn without haste," said a voice like black silk, "or kiss your kidneys goodbye."
The crowd watched with interest. It was turning out to be quite a good day. Rincewind turned slowly, feeling the point of the sword scrape along his ribs. At the other end of the blade he recognised Stren Withel, thief, cruel swordsman, disgruntled contender for the title of worst man in the world.
"Hi," he said weakly.
A few yards away, he noticed a couple of unsympathetic men raising the lid of the luggage and pointing excitedly at the bags of gold. Withel smiled. It made an unnerving effect on his scar-crossed face.
"I know you," he said. "A gutter wizard. What is that thing?"
Rincewind became aware that the lid of the luggage was trembling slightly, although there was no wind. And he was still holding the picture box.
"This, it makes pictures," he said brightly. "Hey, just hold that smile, will you?"
He backed away quickly and pointed the box. For a moment, Withel hesitated.
"What?" he said. "That's fine. Hold it just like that," said Rincewind. The thief paused, then growled, and swung his sword back. There was a snap and a duet of horrible screams. Rincewind did not glance round for fear of the terrible things he might see, and by the time Withil looked for him again, he was on the other side of the plaza and still accelerating. The albatross descended in wide, slow sweeps that ended in an undignified flurry of feathers and a thump as it landed heavily on its platform in the patrician's bird garden. The custodian of the birds, dozing in the sun and hardly expecting a long-distance message so soon after this morning's arrival, jerked to his feet and looked up. A few moments later, he was scuttling through the palace's corridors, holding the message capsule, and, owing to carelessness brought on by surprise, sucking at the nasty beak wound on the back of his hand. Rincewind pounded down an alley, paying no heed to the screams of rage coming from the picture box, and cleared a high wall with his frayed robe flapping around him like the feathers of a dishevelled jackdaw. He landed in the forecourt of a carpet shop, scattering the merchandise and customers, dived through its rear exit, trailing apologies, skidded down another alley, and stopped, teetering dangerously, just as he was about to plunge unthinkingly into the Ankh. There are said to be some mystic rivers, one drop of which can steal a man's life away. After its turbid passage through the twin cities, the Ankh could have been one of them. In the distance, the cries of rage took on a shrill note of terror. Rincewind looked around desperately for a boat, or a handhold up the sheer walls on either side of him. He was trapped. Unbidden, the spell welled up in his mind. It was perhaps untrue to say that he had learned it. It had learned him. The episode had led to his expulsion from the Unseen University, because, for a bet, he had dared to open the pages of the last remaining copy of the Creator's own grimoire, the Octavo, while the university librarian was otherwise engaged. The spell had leapt out of the page and instantly burrowed deeply into his mind, from whence even the combined talents of the Faculty of Medicine had been unable to coax it. Precisely which one it was, they were also unable to ascertain, except that it was one of the 8 basic spells that were intricately interwoven with the very fabric of time and space itself. Since then it had been showing a worrying tendency, when Rincewind was feeling run down, or especially threatened, to try to get itself said. He clenched his teeth together, but the first syllable forced itself around the corner of his mouth. His left hand raised involuntarily, and as the magical force whirled him round, began to give off octarine sparks. The luggage hurtled around the corner, its several hundred knees moving like pistons. Rincewind gaped. The spell died unsaid. The box didn't appear to be hampered in any way by the ornamental rug draped roguishly over it, nor by the thief hanging by one arm from the lid. It was, in a very real sense, a dead weight. Further along the lid were the remains of 2 fingers, owner unknown. The luggage halted a few feet from the wizard, and after a moment retracted its legs. It had no eyes that Rincewind could see, but he was nevertheless sure that it was staring at him, expectantly. "Shoo," he said weakly. It didn't budge, but the lid creaked open, releasing the dead thief. Rincewind remembered about the gold. Presumably the box had to have a master. In the absence of Two Flower, had it adopted him? The tide was turning, and he could see debris drifting downstream in the yellow afternoon light towards the river gate, a mere 100 yards downstream. It was the work of a moment to let the dead thief join them. Even if it was found later, it would hardly cause comment, and the sharks in the estuary were used to solid, regular meals. Rincewind watched the body drift away and considered his next move. The luggage would probably float. All he had to do was wait until dusk and then go out with the tide. There were plenty of wild places downstream where he could wade ashore, and then, well, if the patrician really had sent out word about him, then a change of clothing and a shave would take care of that. In any case, there were other lands, and he had facility for languages. Let him but get to Chimera or Gonim or Ekalpon, and 6 armies couldn't bring him back. And then, wealth, comfort, security. There was, of course, the problem of Two Flower. Rincewind allowed himself a moment's sadness. "It could be worse," he said by way of farewell. "It could be me." It was when he tried to move that he found his robe was caught on some obstruction.
By craning his neck, he found that the edge of it was being gripped firmly by the luggage's lid.
"Ah, Gorfowl," said the patrician pleasantly. "Come in. Sit down. Can I press you to a candied starfish?"
"I am yours to command, master," said the old man calmly, "save perhaps in the matter of preserved echinoderms."
The patrician shrugged and indicated the scroll on the table.
"Read that," he said.
Gorfowl picked up the parchment and raised one eyebrow slightly when he saw the familiar ideograms of the Golden Empire. He read in silence for perhaps a minute, and then turned the scroll over to examine minutely the seal on the obverse.
"You are famed as a student of empire affairs," said the patrician. "Can you explain this?"
"Knowledge in the matter of the empire lies less in noting particular events than in studying a certain cast of mind," said the old diplomat. "The message is curious, yes, but not surprising."
"This morning the emperor instructed,"
the patrician allowed himself the luxury of a scowl,
"instructed me, Gorfowl, to protect this two-flower person. Now it seems I must have him killed. You don't find that surprising?"
"No. The emperor is no more than a boy. He is idealistic, keen, a god to his people. Whereas this afternoon's letter is, unless I am very much mistaken, from Nine Turning Mirrors, the Grand Vizier. He has grown old in the service of several emperors. He regards them as a necessary but tiresome ingredient in the successful running of the empire. He does not like things out of place. The empire was not built by allowing things to get out of place. That is his view."
"I begin to see," said the patrician.
"Quite so." Gorfowl smiled into his beard. "This tourist is a thing that is out of place. After acceding to his master's wishes, Nine Turning Mirrors would, I am quite sure, make his own arrangements with a view to ensuring that one wanderer would not be allowed to return home, bringing, perhaps, the disease of dissatisfaction. The Empire likes people to stay where it puts them. So much more convenient, then, if this two-flower disappears for good in the barbarian lands. Meaning here, master."
"And your advice?" said the patrician.
Gorfowl shrugged.
"Merely that you should do nothing. Matters will undoubtedly resolve themselves. However," he scratched an ear thoughtfully, "perhaps the Assassin's Guild?"
"Ah, yes," said the patrician.
"The Assassin's Guild. Who is their president at the moment?"
"Zlorf Flannelfoot, master."
"Have a word with him, will you?"
"Quite so, master."
The patrician nodded. It was all rather a relief. He agreed with Nine Turning Mirrors. Life was difficult enough. People ought to stay where they were put. Brilliant constellations shone down on the Discworld. One by one the traders shuttered their shops. One by one the Gonoffs, thieves, firewirers, whores, illusionists, backsliders and second-story men awoke and breakfasted. Wizards went about their polydimensional affairs. Tonight saw the conjunction of two powerful planets, and already the air over the magical quarter was hazy with early spells.
"Look," said Rincewind, "this isn't getting us anywhere."
He inched sideways. The luggage followed faithfully, lid half open and menacing. Rincewind briefly considered making a desperate leap to safety. The lid smacked in anticipation. In any case, he told himself with sinking heart, the damn thing would only follow him again. It had that dogged look about it. Even if he managed to get to a horse, he had a nasty suspicion that it would follow him at its own pace, endlessly, swimming rivers and oceans, gaining slowly every night while he had to stop to sleep. And then one day, in some exotic city and years hence, he'd hear the sound of hundreds of tiny feet accelerating down the road behind him.
"You've got the wrong man," he moaned. "It's not my fault. I didn't kidnap him."
The box moved forward slightly. Now there was just a narrow strip of greasy jetty between Rincewind's heels and the river. A flash of precognition told him that the box would be able to swim faster than he could. He tried not to imagine what it would be like to drown in the Ankh.
"It won't stop until you give in, you know,"
said a small voice, conversationally. Rincewind looked down at the iconograph, still hanging around his neck. Its trapdoor was open, and the homunculus was leaning against the frame, smoking a pipe and watching the proceedings with amusement.
"I'll take you in with me at least," said Rincewind through gritted teeth.
The imp took the pipe out of his mouth.
"What did you say?"
he said.
"I said I'll take you in with me, damn it."
"Suit yourself,"
the imp tapped the side of the box meaningfully.
"We'll see who sinks first."
The luggage yawned and moved forward a fraction of an inch.
"Oh, all right," said Rincewind irritably, "but you'll have to give me time to think."
The luggage backed off slowly. Rincewind edged his way back onto reasonably safe land and sat down with his back against a wall. Across the river, the lights of Ankh City glowed.
"You're a wizard," said the picture imp. "You'll think of some way to find him."
"Not much of a wizard, I'm afraid."
"You can just jump down on everyone and turn them into worms,"
the imp added encouragingly, ignoring this last remark. "No, turning to animals is an 8th-level spell. I never even completed my training. I only know one spell."
"Well, that'll do."
"I doubt it," said Rincewind hopelessly.
"What does it do, then?"
"Can't tell you. Don't really want to talk about it. But frankly," he sighed, "no spells are much good. It takes 3 months to commit even a simple one to memory, and then once you've used it, poof, it's gone. That's what's so stupid about the whole magic thing, you know. You spend 20 years learning the spell that makes nude virgins appear in your bedroom, and then you're so poisoned by quicksilver fumes and half-blind from reading old grimoires that you can't remember what happens next."
"I never thought of it like that," said the imp.
"Hey, look, this is all wrong. When Two Flowers said they'd got better kind of magic in the Empire, I thought... The imp looked at him expectantly. Rincewind cursed himself. "Well, if you must know, I thought he didn't mean magic. Not as such."
"What else is there, then?"
Rincewind began to feel really wretched. "I don't know," he said. "A better way of doing things, I suppose. Something with a bit of sense in it. Harnessing the lightning or something." The imp gave him a kind but pitying look.
"Lightning is the spears hurled by the thunder giants when they fight," it said gently. "Established meteorological fact. You can't harness it."
"I know," said Rincewind miserably. "That's the flaw in the argument, of course." The imp nodded and disappeared into the depths of the iconograph. A few moments later, Rincewind smelled frying bacon. He waited until his stomach couldn't stand the strain anymore and rapped on the box. The imp reappeared.
"I've been thinking about what you said,"
it said before Rincewind could open his mouth.
"And even if you could get a harness on it, how could you get it to pull a cart?"
"What the hell are you talking about?"
"Lightning. It just goes up and down. You'd want it to go along, not up and down. Anyway, it'd probably burn through the harness."
"I don't care about the lightning. How can I think on an empty stomach?"
"Eat something, then. That's logic."
"How? Every time I move, that damn box flexes its hinges at me." The luggage, on cue, gaped widely. "See?"
"It's not trying to bite you," said the imp. "There's food in there. You're no use to it starved."
Rincewind peered into the dark recesses of the luggage. There were indeed, among the chaos of boxes and bags of gold, several bottles and packages in oiled paper. He gave a cynical laugh, mooched around the abandoned jetty until he found a piece of wood about the right length, wedged it as politely as possible in the gap between the lid and the box, and pulled out one of the flat packages. It held biscuits that turned out to be as hard as diamond wood.
"Bloody hell," he muttered, nursing his teeth.
"Captain Eight Panther's Traveller's Digestives, then," said the imp from the doorway to his box. "Saved many a life at sea, they have."
"Oh, sure. Do you use them as a raft, or just throw them to the sharks and sort of watch them sink? What's in the bottles? Poison?"
"Water."
But there's water everywhere. Why do you want to bring water?
Trust.
Trust?
Yes, that's what he didn't. The water. Here, see?
Rincewind opened a bottle. The liquid inside might have been water. It had a flat, empty flavour with no trace of life.
Neither taste nor smell, he grumbled.
The luggage gave a little creak, attracting his attention. With a lazy air of calculated menace, it shut its lids slowly, grinding Rincewind's impromptu wedge like a dry loaf.
All right, he said. I'm thinking.
Ymir's headquarters were in the Leaning Tower at the junction of Rhyme Street and Frost Alley. At midnight, the solitary guard leaning in the shadows looked up at the conjoining planets and wondered idly what change in his fortunes they might herald. There was the faintest of sounds, as of a gnat yawning. The guard glanced down at the deserted street and now caught the glimmer of moonlight on something lying in the mud a few yards away. He picked it up. The lunar light gleamed on gold, and his intake of breath was almost loud enough to echo down the alleyway. There was a slight sound again, and another coin rolled into the gutter on the other side of the street. By the time he had picked it up, there was another one, a little way off and still spinning. Gold was, he remembered, said to be formed from the crystallized light of stars. Until now he had never believed it to be true, that something as heavy as gold could fall naturally from the sky. As he drew level with the opposite alley mouth, some more fell. It was still in its bag, there was an awful lot of it, and Rincewind brought it down heavily onto his head. When the guard came to, he found himself looking up into the wild-eyed face of a wizard, who was menacing his throat with a sword. In the darkness, too, something was gripping his leg. It was the disconcerting sort of grip that suggested that the gripper could grip a whole lot harder if he wanted to.
"Where is he, the rich foreigner?" hissed the wizard. "Quickly!"
"What's holding my leg?"
said the man with a note of terror in his voice. He tried to wriggle free. The pressure increased.
"You wouldn't want to know," said Rincewind. "Pay attention, please. Where's the foreigner?"
"Not here. They've got him at Broadman's place. Everyone's looking for him. You're Rincewind, aren't you? The box that bites people. Oh, no, please."
Rincewind had gone. The guard felt the unseen leg gripper release his, or, as he was beginning to fear, its hold. Then, as he tried to pull himself to his feet, something big and heavy and square cannoned into him out of the dark and plunged off after the wizard. Something with hundreds of tiny feet. With only his homemade phrasebook to help him, Twoflower was trying to explain the mysteries of in-sewer ants to Broadman. The fat innkeeper was listening intently, his little black eyes glittering. From the other end of the table, Ymir watched with mild amusement, occasionally feeding one of his ravens with scraps from his plate. Beside him, Withel paced up and down.
"You fret too much," said Ymir, without taking his eyes from the two men opposite him. "I can feel it, Stren. Who would dare attack us here? And the gutter wizard will come. He's too much of a coward not to, and he'll try to bargain, and we shall have him, and the gold, and the chest."
Withel's one eye glared, and he smacked a fist into the palm of a black-gloved hand.
"Who would have thought that there was so much sapient pearwood in the whole of the disk?" he said. "How could we have known?"
"You fret too much, Stren. I'm sure you can do better this time," said Ymir pleasantly.
The lieutenant snorted in disgust and strode off round the room to bully his men. Ymir carried on watching the tourist. It was strange, but the little man didn't seem to realise the seriousness of his position. Ymir had on several occasions seen him look around the room with an expression of deep satisfaction. He had also been talking for ages to Broadman, and Ymir had seen a piece of paper change hands, and Broadman had given the foreigner some coins. It was strange. When Broadman got up and waddled past Ymir's chair, the thiefmaster's arm shot out like a steel spring and grabbed the fat man by his apron.
"What was all that about, friend?"
asked Ymir quietly.
"Nothing, Ymir, just private business, like."
"There are no secrets between friends, Broadman."
"Yeah, well, I'm not sure about it myself, really. It's a sort of a bet, you see," said the innkeeper nervously. "In sewer ants, it's called. It's like a bet that the broken drum won't get burned down."
Ymir held the man's gaze until Broadman twitched in fear and embarrassment. Then the thief master laughed.
"This were Maitland old tinder pile," he said. "The man must be mad."
"Yes, but mad with money. He says now he's got the, I can't remember the word, begins with a P. It's what you might call the stake bunny. The people he works for in the Agatian Empire will pay up if the broken drum burns down. Not that I hope it does burn down. The broken drum, I mean. I mean, it's like a home to me, is the drum."
"Not entirely stupid, are you?" said Emor, and pushed the innkeeper away. The door slammed back on its hinges and thudded into the wall.
"Hey, that's my door!" screamed Broadman.
Then he realized who was standing at the top of the steps and ducked behind the table, a mere shaving of time before a short black dart sped across the room and thunked into the woodwork. Emor moved his hand carefully and poured out another flagon of beer.
"Won't you join me, Zlorf?" he said levelly. "And put that sword away, Stren. Zlorf Flannelfoot is our friend."
The president of the Assassin's Guild spun his short blowgun dexterously and slotted it into its holster in one smooth movement.
"Stren," said Emor.
The black-clad thief hissed and sheathed his sword, but he kept his hand on the hilt and his eyes on the assassin. That wasn't easy. Promotion in the Assassin's Guild was by competitive examination, the practical being the most important, indeed the only part. Thus, Zlorf's broad, honest face was a welt of scar tissue, the result of many a close encounter. It probably hadn't been all that good-looking in any case. It was said that Zlorf had chosen a profession in which dark hoods, cloaks, and nocturnal prowlings figured largely because there was a day-fearing, trollish streak in his parentage. People who said this in earshot of Zlorf tended to carry their ears home in their hats.